Hello, everyone. So, I've seen that historical literature has been a popular tag recently. And so, being inspired, I wanted to do my own and see how far I can get with, before I can't concentrate anymore, I guess. So without further ado, the, book that I've chosen to read is, of course, public domain, and it's The Call of the Wild by Jack London. I briefly remember reading this in school, like a million years ago, but, I can't really remember much about it, aside from the fact that it's a classic, and yeah, I don't mind rereading stuff from, you know, when I was younger, particularly, when Ghost at a Watchman was released, that being the, I mean, depending on who you ask, that's either the prequel, the first draft, or, you know, I believe the story is that it was an original, it was a first or second rough draft that later became To Kill a Mockingbird. So, I mean, already we're off to a great start because I can't even remember the fucking author's name, but it was released after she passed, and if memory serves, the inheritor, or the, whoever had power of attorney over her estate decided that this manuscript should be released, and, I wanted to do my due diligence and read, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird over, just because, you know, I fuzzily remembered it from, I believe, high school. And then, you know, in the way of teenagers, I didn't really think much of it. It was boring, didn't have action, blah, 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 blah. But going back as an adult and reading it with an adult's perspective, I could have a greater respect for it. And so I made sure that I had read that and was up to date with it before Ghost at a Watchman was published and passed out for, sold for consumers. Nevertheless, I'm going off on a tangent, which again, I'm sorry for. I tend to do that at times. Nevertheless, I'm reading Call of the Wild by Jack London. And it was chapter one, Into the Primitive. And it begins with a quotation: old longings, nomadic leap, chafing at customs chain, again from its brumal sleep, awakens the farine strain. It sounds like a poem that's quoted there. Anyway, Buck did not read the newspapers, or he would have known that trouble was brewing, not alone for himself, but for every Tidewater dog, strong of muscle and with warm long hair, from Puget Sound to San Diego. Because men groping in the Arctic darkness had found a yellow metal, and because steamship and transportation companies were booming the find, thousands of men were rushing into the Northland. These men wanted dogs, and the dogs they wanted were heavy dogs with strong muscles by which to toil and furry coats to protect them from the frost. Buck lived at a big house in the sun-kissed Santa Clara Valley. Judge Miller's place, it was called. It stood back from the road, half hidden among the trees, through which glimpses could be caught of the wide, cool veranda that ran around its four sides. The house was approached by gravel driveways, which wound about through wide-spreading lawns and under the interlacing boughs of tall poplars. At the rear, things were on even a more spacious scale than at the front. There were great stables where a dozen grooms and boys held forth rows of vine-clad servants' cottages, an endless and orderly array of outhouses, long grape arbors, green pastures, orchards, and berry patches. Then there was the pumping plant for the artesian well, and the big cement tank where Judge Miller's boys took their morning plunge and kept cool in the hot afternoon. And over this great demesne, Buck ruled. Here he was born, and here he had lived the 4 years of his life. It was true there were other dogs. There could not be but other dogs on so vast a place, but they did not count. They came and went, resided in the populous kennels, or lived obscurely in the recesses of the house after the fashion of Toots, the Japanese pug, or Isabel, the Mexican hairless, strange creatures that barely put nose out of doors or set foot to ground. On the other hand, there were the fox terriers, a score of them at least, who yelped fearful promises at Toots and Isabel, looking out of the windows at them and protected by a legion of housemaids armed with brooms and mops. But Buck was neither house dog nor kennel dog. The whole realm was his. He plunged into the swimming tank or went hunting with the judge's sons. He escorted Molly and Alice, the judge's daughters, on long twilight or early morning rambles. On wintry nights, he lay at the judge's feet before the roaring library fire. He carried the judge's grandsons on his back or rolled them in the grass and guarded their footsteps through wild adventures until to the fountain in the stable yard and even beyond, where the paddocks were and the berry patches. Among the terriers, he stalked imperiously, and Toots and Isabel he utterly ignored, for he was king. King over all creeping, crawling, flying things of Judge Miller's place, humans included. His father, Elmo, a St. Hugh Bernard, had been the judge's inseparable companion, and Buck bid fair to follow in the way of his father. He was not so large. He weighed only 140 pounds, for his mother, Shep, had been a Scotch shepherd dog. Nevertheless, 140 pounds, to which was added the dignity that comes of good living and universal respect, enabled him to carry himself in right royal fashion. During the 4 years since his puppyhood, he had lived the life of a sated aristocrat. He had a fine pride in himself. It was even a trifle egotistical, as country gentlemen sometimes become because of their insular situation. But he had saved himself by not becoming a mere pampered house dog. Hunting and kindred outdoor delights had kept down the fat and hardened his muscles. And to him, as to the cold tubbing races, the love of water had been a tonic and a health preserver. And this was the manner of dog Buck was in the fall of 1897. When the Klondike strike dragged men from all over the world into the frozen north. But Buck did not read the newspapers, and he did not know that Manuel, one of the gardener's helpers, was an undesirable acquaintance. Manuel had one besetting sin. He loved to play Chinese lottery. Also, in his gambling, he had one besetting weakness. Faith in a system. And this made his damnation certain. For to play a system requires money. All the wages of a gardener's helper do not lap over the needs of a wife and numerous progeny. The judge was at a meeting of the Raisin Growers Association, and the boys were busy organizing an athletic club on the memorable night of Manuel's treachery. No one saw him and Buck go off through the orchard on what Buck imagined was merely a stroll. And with the exception of a solitary man, no one saw them arrive at the little flag station known as College Park. This man talked with Manuel, and money chinked between them. You might wrap up the goods before you deliver them, the stranger said gruffly. And Manuel doubled a piece of stout rope around Buck's neck under the collar. Twist it, and you'll choke him plenty, said Manuel, and the stranger grunted a ready affirmative. Buck had accepted the rope with quiet dignity. To be sure, it was an unwanted performance, but he had learned to trust men he knew, and to give them credit for a wisdom that outreached his own. But when the ends of the rope were placed in the stranger's hands, he growled menacingly. He had merely intimated his displeasure, and his pride believing that to intimate was to command. But to his surprise, the rope tightened around his neck, shutting off his breath in quick rage. Oh, fuck. In quick rage, he sprang at the man who met him halfway, grappled him close by the throat. Oh my god. And with a deft twist, threw him over on his back. Then the rope tightened mercilessly while Buck struck in a fury, his tongue rolling out of his mouth and his great chest panting futilely. Never in all his life he had been so vilely treated, and never in his whole life, in all his life, had he been so angry. But his strength ebbed, his eyes glazed. Oh, and he knew nothing when the train was flagged and the two men threw him into the baggage car. Oh, the next he knew, he was dimly aware that his tongue was hurting and that he was being jolted along in some kind of conveyance. The hoarse shriek of a locomotive whistling across it told him where he was. He had often traveled. He had traveled too often with the judge not to know the sensation of riding in a baggage car. He opened his eyes, and into them came the unbridled anger of a kidnapped king. The man sprang for his throat, but Buck was too quick for him. His jaws closed on the hand, nor did they relax till his senses were choked out of him once more. Yep, as fits, the man said, hiding his mangled hand from the baggage man, who had been attracted by the sounds of a struggle. I'm taking him up for the boss to Frisco. A crack dog doctor there thinks he can cure him. Concerning the night's ride, the man spoke almost eloquently for himself in a little shed back of a saloon on the San Francisco waterfront. All I get is 54, he grumbled, and I wouldn't do it over for 1,000 cold cash. His hand was wrapped in a bloody handkerchief, and the right trouser leg was ripped from knee to ankle. How much did the other mug get? The saloon keeper demanded. 100 was the reply. Wouldn't take a suit less, help me. That makes 150, said the saloon keeper. As he calculated, and he's worth it, or I'm a squarehead. The kidnapper undid the bloody wrappings and looked at his lacerated hand. Oh, if I don't get the hydrophobia, it'll be because you were born to hang, laughed the saloon keeper. Here, let me hand, before you pull your freight, these. Oh, God, Dean is suffering intolerable pain from throat and tongue. With half the life throttled out of him, Buck attempted to face his tormentors. But he was thrown down and choked repeatedly till he succeeded in filing the heavy brass collar from off of his neck. Then the rope was removed and he was flung into a cagely crate. Oh my god, there he lay for the remainder of the weary night, as he was wrestling to pride. Oh god, you could not understand what it all meant. What did they want with him, these three men? Oh my god. Oh my god, yes, you. Oh god. Where were they keeping him pent up in his narrow crate? He did not know why, but he felt oppressed by the vague sense of impending calamity. Several times during the night, he sprang to his feet and the shed door rattled open. Expecting to see the judge or the boy sleazed. But each time, it was the bulging face of the saloon keeper. That peered at him by the sickly light of a tallow candle. And each time, the joyful bark that trembled in Buck's throat was twisted into a savage growl with its most longy blade. And then running for it and to pick up the brain. What Buck decided for the what evil creatures raked in on Captain Easton. Personally. Oh, holy la. Only. Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, fuck. Oh, my God, yes. God. Oh, my God. I'm good. More tormentors, Buck decided, for the evil-looking creatures, ragged and unkempt. And he stormed and raged at them through the bars. They only laughed and poked sticks at him, which he promptly assailed with his teeth till he realized that that was what they wanted. Whereupon he lay down suddenly and allowed the crate to be lifted into a wagon. Then he and the crate in which he was imprisoned began a passage through many hands. Clerks in the express office took charge of him. He was carted about in another wagon. A truck carried him with an assortment of boxes and parcels upon a ferry steamer. He was tracked off the steamer into a great railway depot. And finally, he was deposited in an express car. Okay, well, I'm gonna leave it off there. But, holy shit. That was fucking harder than I thought it would be. Oh, God. Oh. I hope that you guys have enjoyed, and let me know if there's like a challenge or something that you want me to do, give a try, or do differently. I'm open to suggestion. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed, and literacy is important, don't forget that. Oh, God. I'm sorry. I'll see myself out. Good night, guys.